Blog Talk Radio.
And welcome to this episode of Let's Talk TV Live House Rewatch. It's my second episode of every week on Tuesday nights. I'm your host, Barbara Barnett. I'm the executive editor of Blog Critics Magazine, owned by Technorati Media. And I'm also the editor-in-chief and publisher of Let's Talk TV, TV Blog. If you like the show, if you've been listening in, please be sure to visit my profile page on Blog Talk Radio and follow us online, better yet, or in addition to, subscribe to my blog at letstalktv.barbarabarnett.com and download the free app available from iTunes and also for Android on play.google.com. Speaking of the app, we are sponsored this evening by Wireless One Marketing, and they can develop for you a great app at a very affordable price. My app was developed by the Wireless One team, so if you want to see what they can do, just download my app, the Let's Talk TV app, and you can reach the Wireless One team at Wireless One Marketing Group 847-637-2514, and they'll give you a free demo. That number again is 847-637-2514, or visit their website at www.app2020.com. Our humble little show is also sponsored by Chasing Zebras, the unofficial guide to HouseMD. It came out in 2010, and it only covers seasons 1 through 6, but there's a ton of information in there. It's 429 pages worth of information. And you can get Chasing Zebras in paperback everywhere books are sold. You can also get it in ebook form everywhere ebooks are sold, including versions for Kindle, for Nook, PDF, iBook, you name it, it's there. You can download it. You can buy it off the shelf. So on Blog Talk Radio's Let's Talk TV Live, we are well over 100,000 listeners. In the first 13 weeks, we have been on the air. We debuted at the very end of October, and we are up over 100,000 listeners. We were totally pushed into this stratospheric number by last Monday's show. I did a show on TV spies with the author of a book, The Encyclopedia of TV Spies, and we ended up, it's just insane. The show, that episode alone has had more than 70,000 downloads in 1 week. Not sure how that happened, but who knows? So spread the word, and our House Rewatch show can surpass all those 70s and 60s spies in a heartbeat, right? Who can beat House? And speaking of great interviews, last night I had on the fantastic Jane Espenson, writer on Once Upon a Time, Buffy the Vampire Slayer, Battlestar Galactica, Game of Thrones, Torchwood, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. It was a great one-hour interview. You can also find on the Blog Talk Radio site under Let's Talk TV my interview with Adam Horwitz and Eddie Kitsis, showrunners of Once Upon a Time. A two-part interview with Joe Malazzi, executive producer on The Stargate, and tons of other interviews in the 13 weeks we've been on the air. Our House Rewatch from last Tuesday kind of started out slow, but it really gained speed, and we've had well over 2,000 downloads since last Wednesday morning. So thank you to everyone who's listening and spreading the word. Please, please spread, and make sure you're in the chat room now, you're listening online. Please give a tweet, say we're here, follow us, spread the word. So my guest tonight is Bobbin Bergstrom, and Bobbin is, apart from the original six cast members, she appeared in more episodes of House than any other actor or actress on the series. She often appears all throughout the series as a nurse and is, in fact, a registered nurse in real life. And you guys are so knowledgeable about House. You already know this. But she was also a medical advisor. She was the on-set medical advisor. And her first episode as medical advisor was Paternity, which we're going to talk about later in the show after Bobbin leaves, because she's got to she's come on the air. She's coming on the air with us as her family is waiting dinner. So I'm going to bring her on in a second. But I want to ask you a trivia question. So Bobbin, when I bring you on, don't give us the answer. and I will send you an autographed copy of Chasing Zebras if you get it right. What is the first episode that Bobbin appeared on camera? Okay, and I'm going to bring Bobbin on. Hello, Bobbin. How are you?
Hi, I'm fine, Barbara. Thanks for having me.
You're welcome. Thanks for coming on. We had a little miscue last week, but I am so glad we were able to connect, and you've come on the show, and I am just thrilled. So I asked a trivia question, so don't tell me what the first episode you've appeared on screen, because people have to tell me. We'll
okay.
see. And if you're listening to this on the download, if you've downloaded it, you're listening to it after the live broadcast, tweet me. Leave me a message on my blog, and I will send an autographed copy of Chasing Zebras out. So we are all of us feeling a little bit of withdrawal after 8 years with House. All of you guys who are in the chat room, everyone who's listening, we're all a little withdrawn about it, probably like when House was going off of Vicodin kind of withdrawal. Which is why I started this rewatch, the second episode of the week. And when we connected a couple of months ago on Twitter, you told me that you and a lot of the crew were also kind of feeling that, just like, oh, you know, we've been with this for a lot of years. So, right? I mean, that's how we started talking about this.
Absolutely right.
So I want to talk about that in more detail, but can you tell us first about your role on the show? I actually mention you in my book. You have a mention in Chasing Zebras right along with David Foster and Linda Sanders and all those guys as a medical advisor. But tell the audience what your involvement in the show was.
Well, essentially, I was brought onto the show from the first episode. The pilot was filmed in Canada, so I did not do that. But when it returned here to be filmed, they invited me to be the on-set medical advisor. And because of some of the complicated medical procedures and being new to Hugh and all of the other actors, I just suggested to the producers it would be easier on them if I played their right-hand nurse. And in many of the episodes, I'm obscured either with a mask or I have my hair different or something like that, so that it doesn't. So I'm not really in, you know, a huge part of the show to be seen as much as I am there to facilitate it looking accurate.
So that's a really interesting approach. I thought that was I had read that and I thought, wow, that's I don't really know of too many other medical shows where they actually do that. Did that really affect how well the actors were able to perform those many functions that doctors usually don't perform, but they did on this show?
That's true. And yes, actually, I mean, my colleagues out in the medical community all are very complimentary about the show and realize the dramatic license we need to take. But they did say that it was probably the most accurate medical drama that they had seen ever. And I feel sort of a great sense of pride in that I had a big part of that happening. I helped the writers. The procedure, what my job basically was a script would come out, and I would review it with the director and the other department heads, and then if I saw that something was not correct, that wouldn't affect the story, I would make a suggestion that they would make a change. For instance, if they had a pediatric patient in an adult ICU room, I would say, well, you're never going to have a six-year-old in the same kind of ICU with adults. So they had to make the ICU look different for peds, and they had signage in other pediatric patients, et cetera. So that really was kind of my role before the shooting of each episode. And then when the episode was being filmed, I would be on set watching the monitors and or being in the scene and also prepping for the next episode. So I was kind of running around a lot for a lot of years.
So were they generally the writers and David Shore, were they generally pretty receptive to, you know, the suggestions that you made?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And the actors really, really want to be told the truth so that they know how far they're bending the truth. and I was very honest, and Hugh and I had a little look we shared with each other when something was kind of far off the radar, but we had to do it that way for the storyline. So, yeah, the writers were, basically it was a negotiation, you know, for I'll let you keep those things that are essential to the story, and then you give me those things that don't matter that aren't accurate and let me fix them.
That's
kind of how.
What was the most outrageous thing that you saw that made you keep in, made them keep in? You can say, because it's like the show is over now.
Yeah, no. Gosh, there's, boy. One that actually comes to my mind is, I think it was called Mob Rules, and there was a pig that was supposed to be, you know, they were doing a transfusion via the pig's liver.
Right.
That one was a little off the charts for me.
I think the show was still kind of finding its feet a little bit when they were
right.
They were doing that. They were kind of roaching a little far into comedy with that episode. I thought did not go down on one of my favorite episodes of season one, and I would say I think I probably had more favorites in season one than I had shows I probably would never watch again. So it was not.
Yeah, I think part of that, too, is they had a lot of the balance of the comedy in the clinic versus the seriousness in the hospital. And it was a really nice mix for you to kind of laugh and then be invested and feel sad for the patient. And then you get brought back up with something funny in the clinic and, you know, sort of exchange there. I thought that worked really well.
Right. And, you know, and then the character stuff, because really, to me, the show, what really made the show for me was House's journey. You
of
know,
course.
It was
100 million other people, without a doubt.
You know, it inspired me to write a whole book about the show, and it wasn't, and there's very little medicine in the book. It's really all about the characters and the ethics and all the really good stuff. You know, of course, there were three cast members that come from medical families as well. So Hugh,
uh-huh.
whose dad was a doctor, and Jesse comes from a medical family, and Lisa Edelstein also comes from
that's right. I met Lisa's dad. He was a pediatrician. I think he might be retired now. Mm-hmm. And Jesse's dad I met quite a few times, and his brother also is a doctor.
Right. So you have to be really careful. You have to, you know, if you come from a medical family, your family is going to, you know, nail you if you get it wrong.
That's right. So I always had a caveat when I had to succumb to some of the dramatic license, and I would ask Lisa or Jesse to in advance tell their family member that this is why we had to do it this way.
Right.
You know, that we acknowledged that it was incorrect, but we had to because X, Y, or Z, because I did feel a responsibility to maintain my credibility, you know.
With Dave. On Orthodox Judaism, so it's like, okay, you've got to pass the family test.
Yeah, right, exactly. That's
so,
right.
You know, you gave me a great example of one of the most kind of absurd medical things. Pig, right up there. But what was the best medicine that you can remember happening on the show?
Oh, wow. Well, there was one episode, and I have to be honest with you, they kind of all run together because it's like one long journey living in the hospital like myself. It's like I sort of existed in that Princeton Plainsboro. So what first comes to my mind, I think it was written by Russell Friend and Garrett Lerner, and it was about a boy that was a twin that was born, and his other twin remained in the mother, and the boy was a twin, and he absorbed his brother.
Right.
Remember that one?
Right. It was the one about chimerism, yeah?
That's right. And so that one was very fascinating to me.
Okay. I know that Garrett and Russell did a couple of episodes, too, that touched on SMA, which I know Garrett's
son, Zeke is his name.
Right.
He's a great kid.
Right. And Garrett and I have spoken several times about that. Both I think it was 97 Seconds, which had a bit, that was the overarching medical story, and also Merry Little Christmas, where there was an SMA patient as well.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was interesting to do that kind of show, and actually there were many episodes that actually mirrored, and I can't believe that it could have been premeditated, because you know there's so much advanced time that it takes to write a script. So by the time we would shoot it, there were so many parallels in the actors' lives that were likened to the script. Like, for instance, it was common knowledge that Jennifer and Jesse were engaged. But then when they actually had their wedding on the show, they had long since become disengaged. So there were interesting twists and turns about that that were painful as a family member. I'll call them, we were like a family, of course, and it was hard to watch that.
You know, yeah, it was actually also hard for the fans to watch, because we all knew the story by then.
Yeah.
And I know that was huge on the internet and huge on in my group of fans who would read my column. That's like, wow, that must have been so hard for both of them. And it's like really heartbreaking to watch that.
It was. It was really hard. And boy, I'll tell you, it's a tribute to their professionalism, because you could not tell on screen what had transpired in the real world. And I don't think I could do that. You know, it's, wow. I adore Jennifer. I still talk to her from time to time. I'm so excited that she's doing well on her show. And it's interesting that you... interviewed her, the writer from her show last night.
I did. And I've actually interviewed Jennifer, but I actually write a weekly column about Once Upon a Time. So I picked up Once Upon a Time after the year before House went off the air. And so I've been writing about it ever since. It's great to see her really grow in that role and do really well in Once Upon a Time as well. So,
yeah. She's a doll.
Before I let you go, and I know that I will keep you on till 6:20 your time, because your family is waiting dinner for you. And I want to ask you to tell me if you have like an anecdote that you want to share about working with Hugh or on a particular episode or, you know, whatever.
Well, the funniest thing, it isn't really funny, but Hugh is such a professional. I mean, really... You know, is as we all adore about him, just is perfect in his craft. When I was in a scene with him where he came in to pull the plug on a patient that was being kept alive for harvesting of her organs, and it was scripted that he came in and he pushed the nurse out of the way, and boy, he really pushed me. I wasn't expecting it, and he wasn't really expecting it either. And so I was like, whoa. So after that, it sort of became a joke that whenever there was something going on in the room and I was his nurse, he would push me.
Well, that goes along with the character, being ornery and all that. So
Yeah,
very cool. Well, it's been such a pleasure to have you on. I hope you come back on the show again.
I would love to. I would absolutely love to, and I'll be listening and I'll be sharing and tweeting with my followers. I have a little fan base myself, and I'm going to have them tune in and listen to the show.
Excellent. Well, thank you so much, Bobbin, and Happy New Year. I have a nice dinner, and I'll talk to you soon.
Thank you so much. Yep, you too. Happy New Year, and I'll talk to you soon.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
That was Bobbin Bergstrom. She was medical advisor on set, medical advisor even during filming, and also playing a nurse in many, many episodes of House over 8 seasons. So it was wonderful to have her on the show. Do you guys like hearing a little bit of inside stuff from her, hopefully? So I want to talk about, because we're at episode 2, and what I think I'm going to start doing as well, I haven't figured out quite how to do it, but I'm going to start embedding the episodes through Hulu on my blog. And I will be posting the new episode probably tomorrow and give you guys, you know, the chance to watch it right online, right from my blog, so you don't have to go finding those season 1 DVDs, which mine are so scratched up, they're almost unwatchable. When I was writing Chasing Zebras, I spent so much time watching and rewatching and rewatching, some of the DVDs don't even play. So I'm going to see if I can figure out how to do that and work with Hulu and or one of the other providers and get those embedded within legal bounds. If I can do it within legal bounds, I will do it. So I wanted to talk about Paternity, which was episode number 2 and the first episode that Bobbin appeared in. It was the third episode shot, and I'm going to ask you guys another trivia question. Maybe you didn't answer my first one, which was the first time that Bobbin appeared on screen in an episode. If you can tell me that, you get to win an autographed copy of Chasing Zebras. Second trivia question is, how can you tell that Paternity was not the second episode to air? Occam's Razor was, I believe, the second episode to air. And there are actually ways you can tell very, very easily by watching Occam's Razor. And should I tell you? And maybe I'll tell you. Maybe I won't do it. Do any of you guys in the chat room now? Come on, type in. Oh, Gabby's typing. She's typing. Do you know the answer? And Katie's typing. Okay. So I'm going to actually hold off. I'm not going to tell you the answer. So hopefully you're going to be answering that. A little bit of a trivia question. If you answer the trivia question, I will send you a copy of Chasing Zebras. If you already have one, I'll send you another copy. You can give it as a gift. Anyway, so the episode, Paternity, is in a lot of ways a very classic House procedural episode. What I mean is procedural, it's a very standalone. You can watch it out of sequence. You can watch it in season 5. And even though House looks a lot different and we've learned a lot more about him, the payoff at the end of Paternity isn't as much of a payoff if you watch it much, much later. Oh, Gabby tweeted to me. Gabby wins a copy of Chasing Zebras. The answer is the first episode that Bobbin Bergstrom appeared in on screen is Role Model, season 1. Ah, oh, she's got her IMDb going. That's a great. All right, so Gabby, if you need to send me your information, do not send it to me right here. Go on my blog and in the contact form, send me your information or direct message me. You can do that, and I will make sure you get a copy of Chasing Zebras autographed by me, not by Hugh Laurie, unfortunately. So it's a real procedural. So if you remember the episode Paternity, it concerned a young man, a high school student named Dan, a lacrosse player. He has night terrors. He collapses while he is playing lacrosse. But House has no interest in Dan's case. He doesn't even know the guy's name. But when he learns that he has been suffering night terrors, House takes great interest because he believes that he has been abused, that Dan's been abused. And when people watch later episodes, and we find out more as we get into particularly into early season 2, and we begin to know that House has had a very difficult relationship with his father, we begin to wonder what is it that that inspires House to be so interested in kids he believes have been abused, not just sexually abused, and he believes that Dan has been sexually abused. But House has a real affinity for children, I think he believes, that are in danger or are vulnerable or are somehow not being treated well. And it kind of is a consistent trope all throughout the series. And it isn't until we learn about House's own troubled background with his dad and also what had happened to his leg, which kind of you understand why he's so empathetic to those who are vulnerable. But you have this episode, which is really, you know, it's a very procedural. You've got Dan, he's got this night. There's this incredibly interesting scene where he's, you know, Dan is having this night terror and House appears to him as a demon. You know, you all remember that scene. And there's also a humorous side story. There's a lot of humor in this because there's the bet. House says this kid is not, you know, this is not genetic. Having the genetics of the parents and the family history doesn't help, because House says this kid was adopted, so the genetics don't matter. So there's this whole bet going on whether this kid is really the natural child of this mother and father. And, of course, House is right. But, of course, Dan already knows that he's adopted. But the whole side story is hysterical. House goes so far as to take the coffee cups of the parents and do DNA testing. And now not only does he find that, you know, that not one parent is his, you know, he doesn't just have one parent that's natural, but both of his parents are adoptive. So they're neither one of them are his biological parents. Of course, that comes into play when we come to the payoff, when we come to the diagnosis, and we learn that it was a remnant of a measles virus that he acquired before receiving his vaccination. And of course, his natural mother, you know, he got the vaccination, but there's that period of time between where you're having your mother's milk and or when you just postpartum, when you have that natural immunity and when you get the vaccination. Well, of course, Dan wasn't breastfed. He was adopted, so he didn't get that extra benefit of the milk. And then on top of that, you also have that great clinic scene. Remember Yummy Mummy? That, to me, was one of those cruel jerk House moments that was also insanely funny. So in the clinic, he's got this Earth Mother. People are tweeting me all over the place. Hey, way to go, Gabby. Feeds her only breast milk. And she believes that she shouldn't have her son have a vaccine. Why? Because vaccines are a corporate scam. So House grabs the frog. You guys remember the frog? And he's playing with the frog, and it is the most strange and unnerving scene, I think, that House has ever had, like with House being seriously demented. And he's playing with the frog, talking about Yummy Mummy, while warning the mom about much less cute, teeny tiny baby coffins that may be in store for her newborn once that natural immunity wears off. So he also has that great clinic beat where he's got that litigious guy, the guy who got like stuck in the leg with the nail, and that's all infected, and who's after very much House's money and is kind of a faker. So Katie says, I find that an interesting episode, being adopted and all, and I am very pro-vaccine. I am also very pro-vaccine, and I don't have any – I'm not adopted. My kids are not adopted. My kids were not breastfed. I could not do that. Oh, too much information, guys. Sorry about that. But I am absolutely pro-vaccination. Many people are not, but I think that yes, Gabby said House described it as a very boring frog, but he made that frog so interesting, didn't he? Very interesting frog. So anyway, so in the realm of House is a jerk. You know, he was a kind of a jerk to the family, right? To Dan, you know, and his parents. And he was even more of a jerk to his parents when he used the coffee cups to grab the DNA sample after he had been, like, so manipulatively, condescendingly sweet, don't you think? So I have a question for you guys, ethical question. So, you know, House did an unethical thing. He ran DNA testing on the parents. Had he not done it without their consent, their son would be dead. Did House do the right thing? He wasn't doing it for the right reason. But can you really seriously fault him for having done the genetic testing? The parents weren't being forthright with him. So what do you think, guys? Katie's typing. I mean, I'm very curious to see what Katie has to say. Very curious. So there's also a great scene, and I know not everybody is a House Cuddy shipper or a fan of the House Cuddy relationship, especially after the season ended. After the series ended, it was kind of a little bit of a mess. But there's a great scene, whether or not you are a Huddy. There is a great scene between them, and it's completely platonic, and it's completely wonderful and delicious, where House has won the bet, but Cuddy has House deliver on the fact that he's used this very expensive DNA sequencer, and she forces him to pay for the testing. This is great. It's very funny, great chemistry between them. So Katie says, she says, he has done the DNA thing, or was it Wilson? Oh, yes. Well, you know, of course, Wilson used the DNA sequencer as well when they were concerned about whether Cuddy had cancer. He went out on a date with her. Remember, Wilson went out on a date with Cuddy, and he took her spoon. And then, again, they did the DNA thing again, trying to find out about Taub's kids. And then House did the paternity testing again. He did paternity testing when in the second-to-last episode of Season 2, he was trying to determine the paternity of his friend's adopted child. So, boy, they really use that sequencer. And Gabby says she, too, is very pro-vaccination. I even get my flu shot every fall. And, Gabby, you are better than I am. I have not gotten a flu vaccine. My husband and I have not gotten flu vaccines. And I'm hoping with the flu season that we have had in the United States so far, I'm really hoping that we don't get the flu. So I am knocking on wood. You hear me? I'm knocking on my desk here, and hope that we don't come down with the flu. Our kids are away at school, so they don't live with us. And I hope our kids have gotten flu vaccines as well. So this is also the first episode. I take that back. I was going to say, I think this might be the first episode where House is watching General Hospital, but I don't think it is. Does he watch it in the pilot? No. You know what? I do think this is the first episode where he shows he's such a General Hospital fan. And eventually, they actually ended up having to change from General Hospital to some other fake, made-up soap opera. Wonder what that was called. Trivia question. No prize here. Okay, so Grandma House 2 or GMA House. I never know if it's GMA or Grandma House. GMA House. I think he did the right thing in DNA testing the parents, although for the wrong reasons initially. But as is often the case with House, even those things he does for the wrong reasons work out, that it gives light to the truth of the matter. And it does make sense. You ask if that makes sense. It does. Because he casts a light on the truth. What is the truth? And House is a truth seeker. And that, you know, that's really one of the things that makes the show so compelling too, is that we always see, you know, what the ethics are, what's going on, what is House doing? And on the surface of what he's doing, it always seems wrongheaded. And I always, you know, there's several episodes that I point to right off the top of my head. And I brought it up last week with maternity. That was one doing that, the clinical trial, the clinical diagnostic, the diagnostic trial on the infants. You know, that if you don't do the diagnostic trial on the six infants, knowing that three of the six infants will likely die, if you don't do it, all six of them are going to die because they're going to not be closer to the truth. And, you know, at some other point during this rewatch show, I want to talk more about House's idiosyncratic ethics. And there's a place to do it. And I there's a couple of episodes where I want to actually devote much of the episode talking about it. There are some other ideas I have as well for guests. I want to bring on my friend who I interviewed for the book, who's a psychologist and a House fan. And we're going to do a little bit of a diagnostic on House. I hope he'll say yes. If you're listening, Bob, my dear friend, psychologist, child psychologist, actually, family psychologist, I hope he'll come on the show and we'll do. You know, I have a lot of ideas. Maybe we'll bring in some of the writers. I'm going to see if I can maybe see if Doris Egan might be interested in poking her head in and saying hi for a half hour, and Kathleen Infelter and some of the other writers that have made the show so memorable that I had a chance to get to know quite well over the course of the season. So back to paternity. So there is a couple of things. For the first time, we see House's apartment. We see how he lives. And I always had a fascination with House's apartment. I devoted an entire chapter of Chasing Zebras to House's apartment. I loved his apartment. I just finished writing a novel, and my protagonist's flat in Chicago looks a lot like House's apartment in Princeton. I really loved that apartment. And we saw it for the first time. We saw the piano. It was a different piano. That piano changed many times over. But we see the piano. We see that he smokes cigars. Gabby also, I'm going to insert here, Gabby, I'm kind of bouncing around a little bit, but I'm kind of responding to the chat room, because those of you who are listening to this on download, and 2,500 of you have downloaded last week's episode, so I'm hoping that a lot of you guys are listening on download. On iTunes, which you can get, by the way, you can get the recording of this show after it airs on iTunes on my blog, letstalktv.barbarabarnett.com, or by coming back to Blog Talk Radio and listening in the archive here. But Gabby says, I think House was right to do the DNA test, but I would have preferred if he asked the parents' consent. House? Asking for parental consent? Boy, when does that happen? That would have been great. It would have been half the show he wouldn't have been able to do. But you're right. You're right. Sometimes you have to do drastic measures to do the right thing. For me, it counts in the end that the patient survives. And that's really what House was all about, saving the life of the patient. Sometimes it was saving the life of his patient at the expense of maybe another patient. And we'll get into that when we get all the way up to episode 14, I think, which is Control, because that's a perfect show to talk about that part of the ethics. But I want to spend the last few minutes talking about, Gabby says, yeah, she's curious who Doris is writing for now. I'm going to message her. I'm going to ask her what's up with her. I think I'm going to email her after the show and talk to her. Or maybe grab her on Facebook or something. So I will find that out, and I will have a report next week, because Doris is too good a writer not to be writing for TV or writing novels. She could be writing her novel right now, to be honest, but I haven't heard much from her lately, so I'm going to see what's going on with her. And I know Doris was a fan favorite. She is sort of to the House fandom what Jane Espenson was to the Buffy fandom and to the Once Upon a Time fandom. And they both actually wrote Torchwood. They both wrote on Torchwood. So Torchwood Miracle Day, which is kind of cool. So, but I do want to talk about House's apartment a little bit, that wonderful apartment. And we'll talk more about that as the year goes on, as the season goes on. But we saw his cigar. The cigar came back, you know, into play as time went on. And all in, we saw him smoking a cigar. And Katie says there are lots of examples of where House did that, even if it upsets people. And it comes off as being reckless, where he does things without consent and nobody's fault, which is one of the best episodes of last season. Really, really is a great example of that. Absolutely. So I want to spend the last couple minutes of our show tonight talking about that final scene in Paternity. A lot of people have said it came too early in season one. And again, it wasn't the first episode that was written, second episode that was written, where you see House standing on the edge of a lacrosse field, watching out over the field. Obviously, his mind is going back to a time where he was much more athletic, played lacrosse himself, possibly, played sports. And it's a very, for the second episode of a series, is extremely wistful, and he play. You know, it's there's no dialogue, and as you guys know, those of you who read me, those of you who talk to me, know that to me some of the best moments on the entire series came in those dialogue-free moments, the moments either between the lines or at the end of this, at the end of the episode, where there are no words at all, just panning in on Hugh Laurie's expression. But that wonderful Ricky Lee Jones' Saturday Afternoons in 1963 and that final scene really provides such a powerful commentary on House's mindset. And it gives us insight, even in the second episode, that there is something very troubling in his mind. He's very troubled. He's haunted by something. And he's very wistful about something. And that's something we don't learn about. We learn about it in little bits and pieces, which was so wonderful. So Paternity on its face, very much a procedural, very much an early season one episode. But so much of it also feeds into what we later find out about House. So last couple of minutes, final comments from the gang in the chat room. GMA House 2, was he really there on the field or was it in his imagination? And that's a point that I really have thought a great deal about. I think he starts out on that empty field. I think the field was empty. I think he goes out onto a field, an empty lacrosse field, and he sees the people playing on it, and it's in his imagination. He does not watch a game. He does not watch a game. Or, conversely, onto the field, he's watching a game that's being played on campus, but he stands there maybe hours afterwards, wistful, ruminating, brooding, thinking, but really lost in his own mind, you know, really in his head. House is such an, for such a gregarious and such an outrageous character, House is also one of the most characters ever written for the small screen. And it really is a heartbreaking scene. I don't know. It could be he was on the field and imagining the play. He could have been seeing the ending of a game and then standing there later. I think that he's imagining it. It could be, as Katie suggests, maybe a hallucination. You know, Gabby, yeah, I think he was on that field. I absolutely think he was standing on a field. There's no question in my mind that the whole thing was in his imagination. He was standing on a field. Whether he actually was watching people play or he was imagining empty field. It's autumn. It's not in lacrosse season. Everything is sort of gray. The grass is brown at the end of that scene. Whether that part's in his imagination, I think that that's true. I think that's right. I think he's watching this field. He's not really, he's more in his head than he is on the field. But I think he's definitely on the field. I don't think the whole thing is a hallucination. So that, we're going to wrap it up for tonight. I want to remind you, please, if you like what you're listening to, please tune in again. Please go on my site, letstalktv.barbarabarnett.com. Become a subscriber. Download the app. Follow the show. Follow Let's Talk TV Live on blogtalkradio.com. Tweet it out. Let's get a huge crowd in here next time. There were 500 people in the chat room last night. We can do as good. Of course, we had Jane Espenson, but that's okay. If I get Doris Egan, do you think we can get 500 listeners live in the studio? I hope so. I think so. Let's do it, guys. So until next Tuesday night, when we will talk about Occam's Razor, it's good night from Let's Talk TV Live, House Rewatch. Good night and have a great week. Bye now.